Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. Today my guest will be Professor Brent Morris of USC Buford, and he's come out with a new book, Yes, Lord, I Know the Road, a documentary history of African Americans in South Carolina, 1526 to 2008. It's a long and sometimes complicated story. I'll have that conversation with Professor Morris, but first, your NPR Newsbreak.
This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today is Brent Morris. He's a Columbia native, but now he's teaching at USC Beaufort. And we'll be talking about his new book, Yes, Lord, I Know the Road, a documentary history of African Americans in South Carolina from 1526 to 2008. Brent, welcome back to the Journal.
Thank you. It's good to be here again. Thanks for the invitation.
1526 to 2008. That's a lot of territory, son.
It's a long history for a couple hundred pages of a small book. It really is.
Well, when you do a documentary study and collection of documents, it gets really hard to select those that you're going to put in it.
Oh, that was the most difficult part of it all. It really was. I started with several hundred and had to whittle it down to about 75, which it's like picking which of your babies you love the most or love the least and getting rid of some. And I finally settled on trying to pick the ones that were either out of print or had been out of print for a long time, sources that were archival that people might not have been able to see otherwise, and also privileging sources that were produced by African-Americans themselves and not necessarily from white observers from outside perspectives.
Okay. And that is hard. And also when you reproduce a document, and certainly the documents related to slavery and African-Americans in terms of the law in South Carolina are lengthy.
Right.
I mean, for the slave codes, we've got a book that's about 3 inches thick. Even if you're going to quote the famous slave code from the 18th century, you didn't quote the whole document.
Oh, no. That 1740 slave code is one of the featured documents in the book, and it ends up coming in at 3 or 4 pages, which I felt was a little bit of a luxury to spend that much time on it. But like you said, these are dozens and sometimes hundreds of pages of documents. And a lot of it is sort of legal minutiae. It's things that the readers wouldn't necessarily value as much. But I tried to sort of look at that document, get to the core of what it was about, and try to pick the sections that told the most about the experience of African-American life in South Carolina during that period and how that law might affect the people on the ground.
Well, having read that slave code, and it is lengthy and touches everything, the behavior of whites as well as the blacks. People
Absolutely.
Don't often realize that the slave code regulated slave behavior. It also regulated master behavior.
Almost as much as slave behavior.
And don't you think that's kind of unusual for a society where individual rights, particularly property rights, were so important?
Well, there was from early on the Barbados example gave and the fundamental constitutions of South Carolina gave masters absolute authority over their slaves. And they retained that into 1740 and beyond the Stonewall Rebellion of 39, but the slave code of 1740. But there was the realization that in order to appropriately contain and control your enslaved people, you had to treat them well. One of the reasons that they finally settled on for the Stonewall Rebellion was poor treatment. Mm. And there are parts of the 1740 slave code that make it illegal to abuse your slaves to a certain extent. Now, you can what they call correct your slaves to a reasonable extent. But if you're constantly beating and abusing your enslaved people, they're going to be, at least in the logic of the 1740 slave code, much more likely to rebel and rise up in rebellion. And that's what they wanted to avoid at all costs. They didn't want to repeat the 1739 Stonewall Rebellion. So there was that. You couldn't work your slaves on a Sunday. You had to give them a reasonable work day, which, you know, in our perspective, it's an unreasonable work day, but you couldn't work them 17 or 18 hours of the day.
But of course, eventually in the rice fields, mm-hmm. they did come up with the tax system, which in essence was a contract between slaves and masters.
It was one of the things that you didn't mess with was that tax system, and it was one of the things that made slavery in South Carolina unique, especially compared with Virginia slavery, which is usually what the comparison generally is. And in Virginia, in tobacco, but also other places ultimately that grew cotton, they worked under what was called the gang system, where a gang of enslaved laborers would go out to the field at sunup and they would work all the way till sundown. It would be constant labor. And it was hard. Now, work under the task system wasn't easy. Rice, which is the crop that was most normally grown under the task system, was, as some historians have said, a hard master. It was a tough master. But the task system basically said that an enslaved person was given a particular task for the day. And generally, it was measured in what an able-bodied male slave could do in a day. But in the rice fields, it was about a quarter of an acre. So you would somehow work a quarter of an acre, whether that was hoe it or weed it or whatever. And then once your task was done for the day, you would be done for the day. And an industrious enslaved person might finish their task by 2 or 3 o'clock, and then the rest of the day they had for their own self, for their own time. And they could grow some crops for their own consumption. They could grow or raise some livestock. They could raise a surplus to go sell at market. They could go worship with their family. They could do just about anything.
They could fish.
Yeah, they could fish.
And even though it isn't often talked about, some of them could even go hunting.
If they were allowed to have a weapon, they could go hunting.
Now, you know, we talked about the slave code, and you've got this dichotomy of slaves produce the wealth.
Right.
So the white population is more than willing to have a 2-to-1 black majority.
Sure.
Roughly. But you've got this dichotomy of fear and greed. And what always wins out?
Greed.
That's right. I mean, that's
greed wins out every time. It's unique to look at the sources that are produced by the slave owners themselves. You see a lot of figures, a lot of numbers, a lot of tabulations of wealth, and that's always very important. But you also see a recognition in a lot of cases of the shared humanity with their enslaved people. Now, they thought they were inferior in every way, but a lot of slave owners, maybe privately and maybe even subconsciously, understood that if the tables were turned and if I were enslaved, well, of course I would rise up. I would try to cut the neck of my enslaver. And there was always that fear that the slaves who were human were just thinking that same thing, only in silence. And they were always afraid that that night they may wake up and their enslaved person may be standing over them with a machete or a knife, and that would be it. But like you say, greed wins out. Slave owners had a short memory, so it was not too long after the Stono Rebellion of 1739, even after that slave code of 1740, that they started to back away from it. And it was a really almost draconian slave code in 1740. But eventually, it was honored more in the breach than anything else.
Well, see, this is one of the ironies, is not just in terms of the slave code of 1740, but when you get into the 19th century and tampering with the mail, not letting anything come in from the outside world, and then sitting around the table discussing what's going on in the outside world, and you've got one or two enslaved persons standing right in the room listening to everything that's going on.
Right. There was and not understanding that they're going to go immediately back to the community and spread those rumors or that news. There was this sense that there's a wall or something that didn't exist. But, I mean, Denmark Vesey, he read about the Missouri Compromise debates going on in Congress. Enslaved people were keyed in to what was happening in the news, and they listened. They had really good ears. When the slave owners would say something, they would listen in because it affected them generally.
You see it in drawings. They'll even talk about a dinner party. Mm-hmm. Or Mary Chestnut.
Sure.
She refers to her butler as a black sphinx, but he's in the house and hears everything that goes on.
Right. Right. There were no secrets among whites at a table, not even considering that their enslaved people would hear every word they said. The shared humanity only went so far in a lot of ways.
I guess looking at this history over half a millennium.
Right.
You included some documents in there, and actually your introduction and your sort of overview of history of African Americans in South Carolina reminds the world, you know, I talk about Spanish South Carolina, but the first slave rebellion in the United States occurred in South Carolina.
Absolutely. The 1526 Spanish colony there, somewhere on the coast of South Carolina. We're not entirely sure.
Well, no, we're not. People from Georgetown, if you go to Georgetown, and remember the signs say Georgetown County since 1526.
Right.
Allion's colonies moved further south. A lot of people now think it's probably in the Beaufort area,
right?
Although some folks in Georgia claim it's a little bit further south.
Well, if you ask Larry Rowland, he would say, of course, everything starts in Beaufort. So it's 1526 right there around Port Royal.
Well, I don't disagree with that. Not that everything starts in Beaufort, and we've had that conversation.
But
I do think, given the harbor, that that's a logical place.
Right. It makes sense. It does make sense.
So did you use Spanish documents?
No, I didn't. And I did use a Spanish. It wasn't a primary source necessarily, but it was a Spanish document, and I had it translated. Trying to get to the original source documents from 1526, those colonial documents, wouldn't have given me necessarily the document I wanted sort of in encapsulated form that would work well in a page or two to really get the story across. But it's a fascinating story to really start the book off with. And I like to say that African-American history starts in South Carolina, or what will eventually be South Carolina, because it's just North America at this point. But there's a Spanish colony that's established along the coast of South Carolina in 1526. And it's not very big, but it's big enough for them to have brought with them African slaves. As was the case with a lot of European colonies, it failed for a lot of different reasons. The leader ended up dying. His successor mistreated the African slaves, but also mistreated the indigenous population of the region. And that led to a combined effort of Native Americans and Africans to, in a sense, overthrow the colony. And that's what they did. They torched the village. And that was the beginning of African-American history, and it was the first slave rebellion in North America. So a lot of things started right there on the ground in 1526.
And then, of course, there were later Spanish settlements, mm-hmm. which had, before you end the 16th century,
right.
At Santa Elena.
Right.
And you have enslaved people there, but you also have enslaved people going with De Soto
sure.
through South Carolina. And wasn't it one of De Soto's enslaved persons escaped to live with the Native Americans?
Oh, he did. It was a man named Gomez. He shows up in the records as Gomez. And he escaped along with an imprisoned Native American princess. And they had, I think the document said, held relations as husband and wife. And, you know, you have, again, it's an example of people of African descent not from the beginning, not sort of accommodating themselves to their enslavement. I really look at the African-American history of South Carolina as one of constantly pushing back, of constantly refusing to just accept their enslavement and to accept their part in that society without a fight, without some sort of resistance and struggle.
You know, people, when they think of resistance, immediately think of rebellions,
right.
Okay, whether it's the one in 1526 or whether it's the Stono Rebellion, which was the largest slave rebellion in American history. And then, of course, the Vesey plot, the Vesey incident, to say it was an actual rebellion, it never happened.
Never got to that point, but there was something there. There was a plan underfoot.
Yeah. So people are aware of those, but let's just assume that you are an enslaved person on my plantation.
Okay.
And by the way, in the 17th century, folks, plantation referred to any acreage of land. It did not mean Tara or 12 Oaks or anything necessarily like that. It could be 100 acres. It'd be 50 acres. It was called a plantation. That was just a 17th century term. Which was later appropriated to mean the Grand Manor. Mm-hmm. You're an enslaved person. How are you going to resist? We don't have the task system yet, and I want you to go out and weed or chop. How can you resist? I mean, after all, I do, you know, we've got those fundamental constitutions. We're still 17th century. I can pretty much darn do with you what I want to.
I'm your absolute property. You have no limitations on what you can do. It's a state of events that every enslaved person had to consider at one point in their life. Outright rebellion was not very often the case, just because it was so hard. These plantations, these farms were sometimes spaced so far apart, and the number of enslaved people living on a particular location would be small. So the planning of it all was not really practical. And the apparatus of the government from the colonial period all the way up to the Civil War was set against African Americans, was set against the enslaved people. And as soon as a rebellion happened, it would be put down. And not just, you know, with a slap on the wrist, go back to your business and keep farming in the fields. It would be, as was the case with the Stono Rebellion, people would be executed, their heads would be cut off and put on pikes up and down the road. I mean, that's what happened between Beaufort and Charleston along what's now, I think, number 17. There would be a degree of terror that would be directed at the enslaved population. This is what happens if you rebel. Running away was an option. It wasn't a common option because a lot of enslaved people had families, and you didn't want to necessarily leave your family behind and escape with your family in tow was difficult. I mean, imagine trying to escape in silence with babies. You couldn't guarantee that. So running away was not always the best option.
If they were running away in South Carolina, at least for 150 years, they were going to head south and not north.
That Southern Underground Railroad that nobody talks about.
Yeah. Well, let's do talk about it.
Oh, well, let's do. Let's take the chance. Yeah. Starting in the late 1600s, the royal governor of Florida, Spanish governor of Florida, said that enslaved people who could escape from a British master would be free once they got to Florida. They had to agree to take up arms and man a fort that was, you know, meant to sort of be the last frontier against a British advance if they wanted to. But there was a steady stream of African Americans who tried to escape to Florida, that promise of freedom. And there was actually a fort that was established in the 1730s called Fort Mose. And it was manned entirely by African Americans who had taken up arms and were ready to welcome people who they might have known coming down from South Carolina, but also to stand and serve the Spanish.
And of course, that was easy before Georgia came into existence.
Well, that's why, one of the reasons why Georgia came into existence. It was established in the 1730s to be not just a drain from the overcrowded jails in England and to get debtors over here, but also, besides just being that humanitarian concern, it was a buffer zone between Carolina and Florida.
And also, slavery was initially prohibited in Georgia, so mm-hmm. a black person coming into what was then, you know, whether it's Ebenezer or Savannah, didn't belong there.
No slavery.
No alcohol.
No alcohol, no Roman Catholics, no large land holdings. It seems a foolish way to set up a colony when you have the example of South Carolina and how wealthy it was becoming because of large land holdings, because of slavery, and because of religious toleration. But Georgia was established with an entirely different goal in mind, and that was to make sure that the English didn't come down and try to expel the Spanish like they had so often. And you know, the Georgians were clever. They actually eventually leased slaves. They looked at the South Carolina example and saw how much money was being made to the North, and they would enter into leases with South Carolina slave owners for 99 years sometimes. They didn't technically own slaves, so they were within the realm of the law, but they were able to benefit from that slave system in some way.
Yeah. Seems to me, I'm sure this is in the Pringle letter book, that he talks about before or after Stono. In Robert Pringle's letter book, Robert Pringle was a merchant. His letter book is the earliest continuous source we have of a Charleston merchant. It predates Henry Lawrence, and it covers this period of the Stono mm-hmm. Rebellion and the Great Charleston Fire a few years later. But he was convinced, as were other Charlestonians and certainly people south of Charleston, that the Spanish had helped inspire mm-hmm. this rebellion. But they always talk about a Spanish priest. You know, well, a Spanish priest would have been in a full cassock and gown. I mean,
he wouldn't have fit in very well.
He wouldn't have fit in. He would not have fit into the landscape particularly. But there could have been Spanish spies. Mm-hmm. In fact, there could have been free blacks coming from Florida, slipping him the other way.
But, you know, blaming it on the Spanish priest is it seems like a common thread that you see going throughout history, because the enslaved people, the white slave owners would have never acknowledged that they would have had the idea to rise up on their own, because they were so inferior and they were so well suited for the work that they did as slaves, they didn't have time to think or to do anything like that. So to blame it on a Spanish priest makes sense. After the Haitian Revolution, you have this terror that there's going to be people coming up from the Caribbean who will be inspiring slaves to rebel. Again, it's sort of saying that the slaves themselves aren't going to be able to come up with these plans themselves. There's got to be white people involved for there to be a good plan.
With Vesey, there were some whites allegedly involved. Mm-hmm. And certainly when you get to Jeremiah Thomas on the eve of the Revolution, mm-hmm. the first thing they did was bring in whites to help be part of the plot.
Well, that's not to say that whites weren't part of the plot, but the ringleaders, I mean, it was Denmark Vesey. He was going to go with his group to Haiti, mm-hmm. but it wasn't the people fleeing the Haitian Revolution that were in charge of the plot. It was Vesey. He was calling the shots. He was naming his lieutenants, and he was getting ready for, you know, a new world.
He, of course, was a free person of color.
He was.
South Carolina began to deal with that issue of freeing slaves, and once again, the state government controlling what a man, and I'll just, or a person, but primarily a man, could do with his property, mm-hmm. as it began to hedge in the possibility of individual emancipation, mm-hmm. or manumission, as it was called.
Right. There was a contradiction that was inherent in free black. Those two words just didn't go together. And that's why a free African American stood as an example of everything that people thought shouldn't exist, of an African American who could exist outside of the oversight of whites, who might actually reject enslavement like Denmark Vesey did. I mean, Vesey had been enslaved. He'd purchased his freedom with the winnings from the lottery, but he continued to be very closely involved with the slave population. And, you know, he was no fan of slavery. I mean, that's why he was playing in the rebellion. So Vesey was very much you know, a free African-American who could read, who was well connected with the politics of the day. He understood current events. That was not supposed to exist. You know, slaves were supposed to have been biologically created for labor. They were supposed to be stupid, like the animals of the field, like beasts of burden. And for somebody like Denmark Vesey to exist, it just sort of flew in the face of everything, all the ideology that white people had to believe in order to believe that slavery was a good institution. And that applied not just to Vesey, but the entire free black population, of which in South Carolina it was pretty considerable.
Charleston's free persons of color, that group before the Civil War became not only fairly large, mm-hmm. but also some of them rather wealthy.
They did. They had their own philanthropic organizations. It was one of the biggest, what they called free brown populations in the colonies and in the country eventually. The Brown Fellowship Society, which was established in the late 1700s as a fraternal organization to cover burial expenses and different benefits for its members. Very often they were of mixed race. And the racial dynamic within the free black population was pretty interesting as well. There was a privilege, just like within the society as a whole, there was a privilege given to lighter skin. So that a lot of the free brown population, they called themselves free brown rather than black or African, they were proud of that connection to the white population. And you actually see when you get right up to the Civil War, once South Carolina has seceded, a significant portion of the free brown population pens a letter to the leaders of South Carolina, basically pointing out how, you know, your blood flows in our veins and we'll do whatever we can to stand with you. Because they understood that their place in this strange South Carolina society was only with the sufferance of the whites. And only by sort of pledging their loyalty could they hope to retain any sort of privileged space in that society going forward.
Well, interestingly, in the other southern city which had a large mixed-race population, New Orleans, mm-hmm. also they were free persons.
Sure.
They volunteered and they actually had a unit in the Civil War. South Carolina's leadership declined and would not take the offer of the free black South Carolinians to form a unit.
The same was the case in the Revolutionary War as well. There was this terror of seeing a black man with a gun. That was just too much for a lot of whites.
Except certainly with the partisans, there were a number of both enslaved and free persons of color who fought in the Revolution.
There were a handful that fought with Francis Marion, that fought at, I think, Kings Mountain and Cowpens and different places.
Yeah. It's a fascinating story. Let's kind of move out of the colonial period now.
Right.
Again, we'll have this role play. You've been my faithful enslaved person for the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be a really good guy, and I want to give you 50 acres, and I want to make you free. And it's now 1830. Can I do that?
You can't. This is one of those things.
But wait a minute. I can't do what I want to do with my property?
You can't necessarily manumit your slaves. That's one of the things. It's one of the limitations that seems to go with this constant terror and the distrust of free blacks, but also the feeling that they're going to do something to try to bring down the system. So an independent black farmer would have represented all that was not supposed to exist with slavery. And the ability to do what you wanted to do with your property had the limit. You know, it's often said you can swing your fist, but your right to swing your fist stops when it hits my face. You have the right to do with what you want with your property until it starts to chip away at the foundation of slavery's justification intellectually.
There are, of course, exceptions. You've got Ellison over in Stateburg who becomes a free person, has a pew in Stateburg Church.
Owns slaves.
He owns about 60 slaves, which puts him in one of the largest slave owners in the South.
Right.
I was having a conversation last week with a friend of mine in Charleston, Robert Rosen, who's written the history of the Jewish community in Charleston. And he got into a very heated debate when he was making a presentation in New York when he said the free black population of Charleston owned more slaves than did the Jewish population of Charleston. And they didn't want to believe that free persons of color actually owned slaves. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes folks will say, well, an individual who's free purchased their spouse or children or what have you. That wasn't really always the case. It was economic.
Yeah, it was. I mean, there were cases where you would, you know, work for years to earn enough money to purchase your family one by one, and you would be the legal owner of those people. You would own your family. But like you said, in the case of William Ellison around Sumter, Ellison was a skilled maker of cotton gins, made some of the best gins in the country. Well known for that, he had purchased a pew in the church. He owned, I think in the 60s, the number of slaves that he owned that worked in cotton fields for him as bondsmen. These weren't his family members. They were workers. They were big cogs in the machine that was meant to line his pockets.
And the house in which he lived was the house in which Mary Chestnut was born.
Absolutely. Yeah.
He bought the house of a former governor.
Mm-hmm. So there was that. There was the buying into the system that seemed to pay off so well.
And now, people don't often, when they talk about buying children or buying family, if a black woman were free, that's very important, because regardless of the status of her husband, all of her children will be free.
Right.
A child assumes the status of the mother.
Mm-hmm. Went back all the way to the beginning of chattel slavery in South Carolina with the first immigrants from Barbados.
It goes back to the Roman Empire.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. But slavery, the status of slavery follows the mother. And this is why when you have relationships between a slave owner and their enslaved women, the children who might be the children of the owner are the slaves of the owner as well. But, you know, they're often sold away to get rid of, out of sight, out of mind, that reminder of the dalliances of the slave owner with his enslaved women.
The whole question of miscegenation or amalgamation of the races, which that phrase began to appear in the 1840s and 50s, mm-hmm. that became one of the major concerns, because by 1860, South Carolina's population was 60% African American.
The largest black population in the country.
Yes. Mississippi also had a black majority, but it was not 60-40.
No.
And one of the ironies in referring to African Americans as a minority in South Carolina history, African Americans had been a majority of the population for more years in South Carolina than they had been a minority.
First majority in 1708. It was slight, but it was there. And for most of the rest of that history, up until the 20th century, it was a black majority.
Well, there was a brief period between 1790 and 1820 when it was a white majority.
Before that, short staple cotton took over and you needed more slaves to be brought in.
Well, and you also had the fact that 25,000 slaves disappeared in the American Revolution.
Right, right.
Either escaping or, in many cases, killed or carried off by the British.
Right.
So that and the in-migration of the Scots-Irish to the back country. So you had, but then from 1820 until 1922, which mm-hmm. South Carolina actually advertised in its industry-seeking material in 1922, that we are now a white majority population. So anyway, just one of those interesting ironies of history. But the whole idea of amalgamation, miscegenation, after the war, the whole question of interracial relationships changes the concern in terms of the law changes after freedom, after emancipation, trying to draw as severe a line as you possibly can. Interracial marriage was forbidden. Eventually, whether a person was black or white was defined by law. Now, this is another one of those interesting ironies. Before 1865, it was not defined in South Carolina.
No.
It was up to the local community as to whether a person was black or white.
That social construction of race, not biological necessarily.
Yeah. And again, we're dealing with the demographic reality.
Mm-hmm.
60%. You know, there are only 10 white majority counties in South Carolina. And except for maybe Greenville and Pickens, you get to places like York and Union, the white majority is very small.
In Reconstruction, you have a lot of former Confederates disfranchised, and you have what a lot of whites call the world turned upside down, where you have African Americans who now have the ability to vote, have the ability to stand for office, and they do, and they run, and they win. And for a brief window there, you actually have large numbers. And South Carolina is the only state in the Union to have a majority of its state legislators at any point to be African American. And there are close to 500 African-Americans who win some sort of elected post in, during Reconstruction, whether it's from a local sheriff all the way up to a lieutenant governor, a state Supreme Court justice, congressman. South Carolina is one of the places where race is or at least racial privilege is turned up on side of its head.
Trustees of the university.
Trustees of the University of South Carolina. University of South Carolina itself becomes 90% African-American. And that's mainly a function of the white students withdrawing because they don't want to be in the same classrooms with African-Americans. But for that brief window, things change significantly. And South Carolina starts to look like the type of society that might actually have a 60% black population because they represent a large chunk of the elected officials. But then after Reconstruction, as a reaction to that, things go 180 degrees in the opposite direction. So you have the rise of folks like Ben Tillman, who's one of the main functions that Tillman has in the late 1800s is to disfranchise African-Americans, to make sure that not just that they don't vote, but that they aren't being able to be swayed by the rich and the powerful, the elites of society, and used against, the farmers that Tillman meant to represent, the common man. So racism was used as a way for whites who are a minority to hold on to power, to make sure that they had it. You know, the African-American voters, people like Tillman thought, couldn't be trusted. And that was one of the reasons that all those laws had to be passed during Jim Crow in South Carolina.
Well, of course, when he was running for governor in 1890, his conservative opponent appealed to the black vote.
That was what Tillman was terrified of.
And our 1895 Constitution, of course, disenfranchised all but a handful of African-American voters. And shortly thereafter, the spate of Jim Crow laws began to take effect.
And that the Constitution, it disfranchised voters legally in a way that technically satisfied the requirements of the 15th Amendment. It didn't disfranchise people specifically based on race. But if you've got a property qualification that most African-Americans aren't going to be able to meet, the impact of that law is that most African-Americans will be disfranchised. If you have a tax that has to be paid to vote, when impoverished African-American families have to choose, well, you go cast a vote or you feed your family, survival very often won out. So it was a way to disfranchise a large chunk of a particular race without specifically saying that's what you were doing.
But those same qualifications were not applied to the white sharecroppers in the upcountry.
It cast a wide net. Yeah, it did disfranchise a lot of whites at the same time.
But eventually they got back to vote.
They did. And there was also, there was violent intimidation that worked into it as well.
And I'm trying to remember now the laws that came into effect after 1895. It's basically the local registrar controlled who got on the rolls.
Sure.
So except for a place like Beaufort County and Georgetown County, which were two exceptions after the end of Reconstruction, the black power structure that had been created between 1867 and 1877 pretty much disappeared.
Yeah, but that's also a function of demographics. I mean, in somewhere like Beaufort, you still have a very large black majority. Into the 20th century, there's not much of a Klan presence in Beaufort County. So, you have somebody like Robert Smalls, who's able to hold an elected position into the second decade of the 20th century. So only where the black population is large enough and strong enough to refuse to sort of be cowed by these exclusionary laws does that happen. And the black population overall in the state is going down from this time period between, the end of Reconstruction and World War I.
It's still 60% in 1890, and then there's a huge exodus beginning in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Mm-hmm. And ironically, the General Assembly begins to get concerned that we're all of a sudden losing our labor force, and they pass laws because they're accusing Yankees of coming down here and buying African-Americans railroad tickets and taking away the labor force.
There's cases where African-Americans are discovered to have two or three train tickets on their person, and they're beaten up and they're thrown in jail. There's laws that are passed to keep outsiders from coming in, and like you said, what they called enticing them away. They were the labor force, and it was one of those strange and ironic things that their racism, South Carolina whites' racism, only extended to the point where they could control the black labor pool. They didn't want to get rid of black people because then they would lose their entire labor force, but they had to keep them at the bottom of society and somehow try to figure out a way to make them stay at the bottom of that same society so that they could pick the cotton.
Brent, we're going to have to speed up. Alfred's just reminded. This is why I think the topic is so fascinating. One last thing about the trains. If you check the African American exodus from South Carolina, it follows the Southern Railroad, the Atlantic coastline, the seaboard. And that's where you have South Carolinians end up in places like Buffalo and Philadelphia and so forth.
And then the laws ultimately were not effective. And trains would run special trains in order to satisfy the demand for African Americans to get out.
Well, let's move quickly to the 1930s. The exodus, of course, is still going on. But the 1930s sees the NAACP outside, it seems to be, of the observation of the white community, become a very strong underground network with the black community statewide.
It does. The membership in the local NAACP chapters grows tremendously during the 1930s. And it's one of those things that, with the economy being so bad and only sort of starting to pull itself out of depression over the course of that decade, racial uplift groups like the NAACP are working not just to help out people when it comes to the bottom line or their pocketbooks, but actually to build a foundation for bettering those lives socially. And what you see coming out of the 30s, coming out of the Great Depression, is a very strong foundation that does lead to the advances that we see happening in the 1940s and the 1950s and ultimately, you know, blossoming with the full-on civil rights movement in the 1960s.
Well, you've got cases challenging the Democratic primary. Mm-hmm. You've got cases challenging teachers' pay, all of which take place in the 1940s.
Right, right. All that is built on the foundation of what was begun in the 30s, actually going back to the 20s, because you have instances in the 1920s where in Charleston, where you have schools with African American students wanting black teachers. So they bring these cases to court, and with the assistance that only a group like the NAACP can provide, are able to have legal counsel that brings these cases to court and incrementally improve life for African Americans in South Carolina.
Well, one of the misconceptions about the NAACP, at least in the white community at that time, was it was the leadership. It was the clergy, successful merchants, funeral home owners, and occasional attorneys, not that many. They didn't realize that farm laborers and household servants were paying their nickels into the NAACP. The roles that Pat Sullivan and others have uncovered about the South Carolina NAACP are amazing in rural counties where you have got sharecroppers, tenant farmers paying their nickels to the NAACP.
Yeah, this is a growing working class movement. And these are people that are, for the time, becoming very, very radicalized. And a lot of people also look at the NAACP as a sort of a conservative organization. But that was the group that you worked through if you wanted to enact some sort of change. So you do have these farm workers. You do have people who, if they were in somewhere other than South Carolina, might have been more likely to join a union. But in South Carolina, they do pay their fees yearly to the NAACP because they know this is the group that's going to be working to help us out. They're the ones who bring the case to break down the all-white primary in the Democratic Party, that eventually bring the case that becomes Briggs versus Elliott, which is wrapped into Brown versus Board and desegregates schools.
And the phrase that the Supreme Court used in the famous 1954 decision, that segregation per se is discrimination, is inequality.
Right.
Came out of the mouth of a South Carolinian.
Yeah, Wade is Waring, who had issued going back to Elmore versus Rice in the South Carolina Democratic primary. He's the one that said that it's time for South Carolina to rejoin the Union. It's time for South Carolina to act like the rest of the country when it comes to race. Very progressive man who was eventually run out of South Carolina for his views.
Well, that and he. Divorced. He was divorced too.
He was divorced and married a New York woman. That'll do it.
So we mentioned Briggs versus Elliott, which rolls into the famous 1954 decision, and it is a landmark. But things don't move quite as fast in terms of South Carolina or anywhere else, but particularly here in South Carolina.
No, it's true. You, if you sit in a U.S. history survey course, you might hear that Brown versus Board was in 1954 and then assume that everything was solved right after that. But it did. Brown versus Board did very little. There was another ruling the next year that people have called Brown 2 that basically lays out the timetable for that. And even that was not specific. It just said with at some point in the future, things need to be done to desegregate the schools. And in South Carolina, it was a slow process.
Did you go to segregated schools? Probably not.
Not legally, but, you know, in fact, it was probably 90% white where I went to school.
Okay. And you grew up here in Columbia.
Right. Grew up in Chapin.
But legally, it was not segregated.
Absolutely.
But legal segregation was still in effect in the 1960s.
Yeah. It was 1970 before the South Carolina public schools operated on a unitary system where African Americans and whites could go to the same school. 1970, you know, 16 years after the Supreme Court says school segregation is unconstitutional, 16 years it takes South Carolina to actually follow through with what the Supreme Court said had to be done. It was easier to integrate the colleges of South Carolina, and that happens, I mean, still a long time afterwards, 1962 when Harvey Gantt goes to Clemson, and then USC in 1963. But it's a long and arduous process.
All right. And your book goes through 2008. I guess some people think, well, once we've got unitary schools, once we've got the Civil Rights Act of the 1960s, everything's over. But race is still a part of everyday life in South Carolina.
It is. I've actually got an excerpt of a publication that Jim Clyburn put out called Race Still Matters, and that's from 2003. And the book actually ends, that 2008 ends before a lot of the things in the last few years that have really shown how much race is still an issue in South Carolina. I had to go back just as the book was going to press and add some things in about the Confederate flag, about things surrounding the Charleston shooting and Dylann Roof, and how race seemed to all of a sudden just sort of explode back onto the scene. Things haven't stopped. And just with 2008, with the election of Barack Obama, and that's actually the last document of the book, is the acceptance speech that Obama gave to a Columbia crowd when he won the Democratic primary in 2008. A lot of people sort of looked at that moment, not just in South Carolina, but nationwide, and said, oh, well, we're going to elect a black president. We're going to live in this post-racial society. And clearly that's not what happened. And very much it's not been the case in South Carolina.
Well, have you got a selection from the more modern period that you would like to read?
Yeah, let me choose one of these. Yeah, one of the great speeches, political speeches from the more recent period is actually Jesse Jackson's speech that he gave at the Democratic National Convention in 1988. And, that's a really interesting speech. Of course, Jesse Jackson wasn't going to win the nomination, but he took the opportunity to sort of say, you know, here's where I've come from. Here are what some of the problems are that I identify in society, and here's what we need to do to be successful going forward. So this is 1988. It was the Democratic Convention in Atlanta, and Jesse Jackson gives this speech. He had run before in 1984. He was running again in 1988, and he had enough delegates to have a pretty strong second-place showing. And this is excerpts from the speech he gave. "Tonight we pause and give praise and honor to God for being good enough to allow us to be in this place at this time. When I look out at this convention, I see the face of America, red, yellow, brown, black, and white. We're all precious in God's sight, a real rainbow coalition. My right and privilege to stand here before you has been won in my lifetime by the blood and sweat of the innocent. As a testament to the struggle of those who have gone before, as a legacy for those who will come after, as a tribute to the endurance, the patience, the courage of our forefathers and mothers, as an assurance that the prayers are being answered, their work has not been in vain, and hope is eternal. Tomorrow night, my name will go into nomination for the presidency of the United States of America. We meet tonight at a crossroads, a point of decision. Shall we expand, be inclusive, or suffer division and impotence? Tonight, I salute Governor Michael Dukakis. He's run a very well-managed and dignified campaign. No matter how tired or how tried, he always resisted the temptation to stoop to demagoguery. I've watched a good mind fast at work with steel nerves guiding his campaign out of the crowded field without appeal to the worst in us. I've watched his perspective grow as his environment expanded. I've seen his toughness and tenacity close up. I know his commitment to public service. Mike Dukakis' parents were a doctor and a teacher. My parents, a maid, a beautician, and a janitor. There's a great gap between Brookline, Massachusetts and Haney Street, the Fieldcrest Village housing project in Greenville, South Carolina. He studied law. I studied theology. There are differences of religion, region, and race, differences in experiences and perspectives. But the genius of America is that out of the many, we become one. Providence has enabled our paths to intersect. His four parents came to America on immigrant ships, my four parents on slave ships. We're in the same boat tonight. America is not a blanket woven from one thread, one color, one cloth. When I was a child growing up in Greenville, South Carolina, and grandmother could not afford a blanket, she didn't complain and we did not freeze. Instead, she took pieces of old cloth, patches, wool, silk, gabardine, corker sack, patches, barely good enough to wipe your shoes with. But they didn't stay that way very long. With sturdy hands and strong cords, she sewed them together into a quilt, a thing of beauty and power and culture.
I think.
And let me, I'm going to skip ahead. Let me just read the end of it because that's a great sort of ending here. And at the end of the speech, he addresses the audience, addresses South Carolina, specifically African-Americans from his home state. Hold your head high. Stick your chest out. You can make it. It gets dark sometimes, but the morning comes. Don't you surrender. Suffering breeds character. Character breeds faith. In the end, faith will not disappoint. You must not surrender. You may or may not get there, but just know that you're qualified and you hold on and hold out. We must never surrender. America will get better and better. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. On tomorrow night and beyond, keep hope alive.
Well, I can imagine in his delivery that keep hope alive, his voice would have gone up. He would have paused and...
There's no way that I've done that justice. It's true. And there's so many other documents in here that there's no way that in my speaking could do it.
Well, I wasn't trying to criticize the way you did. I was just trying to say, having heard Jesse Jackson speak.
Oh, no. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the rhythm of his speech would have...
There is something that's lost in doing this book. You do miss that cadence of Jesse Jackson's speaking. I've got a passage in here that's a reprinting of the Beatitudes from the Gullah Bible. And to not hear that, I mean, it's not meant to be a written language, but not to be able to hear that, the Gullah version of the Beatitudes, you do lose something in it. You realize the beauty of what the language is about, and you get a sense of, you know, the African contribution to Black culture in South Carolina, but you can't get it if you don't hear it. But for the best we can do, I guess, is with the documents, get them to people. And if they want to, they can go find an audio file of that and really get the experience.
Well, that's one thing, Brent, with your book. And somebody's going to say, well, he didn't print the whole this out of the other. You let your reader know where the entire document is available. So if they really want to read, for example, all of the gospel, that particular gospel in Gullah, I've got a copy of it. If they want to, they know where to get it.
And that's, you know, one of the things that historians do is we're not supposed to know everything. We're just supposed to know how to find it. And one of the things that we also do is tell people how to go find the stuff that we don't get to. You know, when we teach a class, there's no way we can cover everything that happened within a particular time period or a particular region. And our job is to know where to send people. And what I've done with this book is told people where to go. You know, starting with hundreds of documents, I had to willow it down to a very small amount. But the footnotes will tell you where to go. It'll tell you what archive to go find, what book to go track down that might be out of print, you know, who in the, you know, go find your interlibrary loan department and get them to get the book in your hands. If you want to go farther, if you want to know more, if you want to read the full document, the ability to do that is clearly found in this book.
All right. Well, Brent, Alfred's giving us the wind-up sign. Any last words?
Well, one of the things that I found in this book is that the people that I'm writing about were conscious of where they were in history. They understood almost, you know, every case, that what they were doing, the acts that they were taking, the reforms they were trying to implement were based on a foundation of people that had come before them. And they weren't necessarily even doing it for themselves. They were doing it for the future. So there's always this interconnectedness with the past and the future. And I end the book, actually, or at least the introduction to the book, with a quote from Harvey Gantt in the early 21st century. Of course, Harvey Gantt was the man that first integrated Clemson University in 1962. But Harvey Gantt was a very interesting person, and he ended up becoming a politician, eventually mayor of Charlotte. He ran for U.S. Congress, and one of his interns was a young Barack Obama. But Harvey Gantt was very much aware that his story, his life story, was one that started on a slave ship 400 years before. And he could look all the way back, understood that what he was doing would not have been possible except for all the people that had come before him, even the folks on that first slave ship. And he said, we've got a long way to go. And that's absolutely the case. I mean, problems are not solved in a generation. And even though South Carolina of 2008 may look totally different from South Carolina of 1858, there's still a long way to go to solve all the problems from the legacies of that early generation. Yeah.
Yes. Can acknowledge that South Carolina has come a long way. That's the opening line. And he appreciates that it represents neither the beginning nor the end. And he said, clearly from my vantage point, we still have much to do. And he was referring not just to one segment of the population, he's referring to the entire population of the state.
Right.
And given the events of the last 3 years, it's still true.
He was absolutely right.
Okay. Brent Morris, history professor from USC Buford, thanks again for being with us today on The Journal.
Thank you, Walter. Glad to be here.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. It was a pleasure having Brent Morris back on the journal again. Brent's a longtime friend, and he is an incredible historian of our state and the American South. This book was many years in the making, but well worth the wait. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETB Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.